Travel with Rick Steves is brought to you by American Airlines, with 4,000 flights to 250 cities in some 40 countries around the world every day. It's easy to book your next flight at AA.com. American Airlines knows why you fly. I'm Rick Steves, and this is Travel with Rick Steves. And today, we're exploring Spain. And we're not going to be talking about, you know, museums and palaces. I want to talk about the culture of Spain. And to do that, I've got a man named Julio Astor, who's from the northwest part of Spain, who has lived most of his life in Madrid. And now he works with the Spanish Tourist Office in Chicago. And Julio has joined us to learn a little more about his exciting country. Julio, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Rick.
You know, you come from Galicia, and a lot of travelers are surprised when they go to Spain that if you go to a, you know, your equivalent of a Subway sandwich shop, you find the menu in four languages. You've got, what, Galician, Basque, Catalan, and Castilian, right?
Right.
Tell me about the four languages of Spain.
Well, actually, there are four, yeah, official languages, the four that you have just named. Three of them, Castilian, Catalan, and Galician, have a common root in the Latin language. The fourth, which is Basque, has an unknown origin. It's completely different, has nothing to do with the other three. Castilian, Galician, and Catalan have a lot of things in common with Portuguese, French, or Italian.
Okay, so those are romantic languages.
Absolutely.
But can a person speaking classic Galician, can he understand somebody speaking Castilian?
I think everyone in Spain understands Castilian because it's the official language.
But let's say they just speak one language.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to understand, for instance, English and German are both Germanic languages,
mm-hmm.
but I can't understand a German talking, even though our languages are related. Castilian, Catalan, and Galician are related.
Mm-hmm.
Can people read each other's newspapers, or are they so different that they are truly different languages?
No, they are truly different languages.
Okay.
They can hardly understand parts of a phrase, or they can relate some words, but they are different.
But Castilian is the official language of government and commerce and so on.
Yes. In all of Spain, it's Castilian is official, but then in certain regions, there is another language which is co-official. So it's as official as Castilian.
I see. Now, as Europe is uniting, it's very interesting to me. 20 years ago, Madrid was threatened by Basque separatists and Catalan, the people around Barcelona, separatists and so on. And they had to deal with all over Europe. They were dealing with these problems of ethnic minorities in countries wanting to break away or have more autonomy. My sense, Julio, is that as Europe unites, nations become less threatened by regions because nations matter less and it's all Europe and Europe is actually promoting the regions. Is your take that as Europe unites, Madrid is less threatened by the people around the Catalans around Barcelona and they will ease up on restrictions for them to wave their flag and do their dances and so on?
Yes, I think so. I think Europe is the idea of Europe is a great umbrella that really takes part of a traditional role that states have played in the past in Europe. So regions are more free to express themselves, to have their own cultural autonomy without states being threatened by that because they have themselves integrated, you know, in a higher process.
So Madrid is less threatened by Barcelona. So if somebody was in Barcelona, they could consider themselves Catalan or Spanish or European?
I think they most of them would consider themselves the three things.
Is there a generation difference? Would older people consider themselves Spanish and younger people consider themselves Europeans?
Yes, I think so. I would say I'm 41 and I'm about in the middle of these two generations. I grew up, when Franco was Franco and his regime was dying, and I started pretty young, traveling around Europe with my backpack. The generations following have done that on a more regular basis, and most of them have even studied abroad.
Well, now young people, they study all over Europe. There's programs that fund intercultural study programs. There's these $20 or 20-euro flights all over Europe. So
yeah.
People can have lunch in Paris if they want to.
Yeah.
And they're very at ease with the different languages and so on. You know, we just heard about the struggles that Europe is having with its constitution and so on. But my understanding is Europe kind of takes two steps forward and one step backwards. And it's been evolving really since after World War II, I think 1947. And to me, these Euro visionaries are just trying to talk European countries into trading away their sovereignty, which is quite a trick. But Europe proceeds in this slow and fitful way. What's your take on this, on the status and the momentum of the European Union?
Well, I think that you have to be aggressive to get something done in this. And because of what you said, it's a very hard thing to do, ask a country to
give up sovereignty.
Give up sovereignty. That's,
yeah, but Europe is nothing. Europe is nothing without people giving up sovereignty.
Yeah, that's it. So they're, you know, the visionaries that you said, they're always pushing the envelope. That's why Europe goes back and forth. Well, you take a step and then maybe half step back to regroup and let time do the job.
So Europe is not threatened. The concept of the unification of Europe, it's a long-term inevitability, I suppose.
Yeah, and there's some ground that, you know, that is solid ground that's never going to go back. You're not going to go back to previous stages.
Now, in Brussels, they've got a fair amount of money to fund different initiatives, and I've found that they will favor regions over national initiatives. If they see some Catalan or some Basque cultural need, they're more likely to pay for that than a Spanish need. Specifically, I remember I've got a friend in the Tyrol, and Tyrol doesn't know borders between Germany and Austria and Italy. Tyrol is an ethnic region that predates those borders, and Europe is kind of charmed by that, and I think it's more likely to give money to initiatives that make Tyrol sparkle. Do you find that's the same for regions in Spain?
Yes, actually it's the same for all over Europe because the structural funds are organized around regions. So we have, every country has a different level of regions. We have what they call Objective 1, Objective 2, Objective 3, depending on the development stage where they are. And they compare, you know, the standards of living and the average income to the average of the European Union.
Right.
So all those programs are regional.
And a lot of programs then, a lot of programs are recognizing the weaker links economically in Europe and investing in those.
Mm-hmm.
Has the EU been good for Spain overall?
Yes. I would say it's been wonderful for Spain.
Why?
It's 1986 is when we joined the EU, and you just had to go to Spain before that and 10 years after or now.
So Spain has really benefited from Germany and France recognizing they want to create a big, strong economic unit, and they're investing in, Spain was quite a basket case economically back in the 80s, I guess.
Yeah, I would say, the most apparent changes are, infrastructures and, modern airports and things that you wouldn't see before. But those are not the most relevant changes. I think the most relevant changes are in the mentality, in the openness, and I would say Spain has been living for a second golden age since the end of the 80s.
Since the end of Franco and the ascension of the whole notion of Europe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's great. Now, in Spain, you've got an interesting demographic problem, ethnic problem. You've got a lot of Africans sneaking in. I was just astounded that people are coming in from Morocco at midnight in their boats and washing ashore, just like Mexicans are jumping over fences in Texas. What's the deal in that?
Well, that's happening all over the developed world. In this global world of today, people get to see the wealthiness of their neighbors on their satellite TVs, on the radios. It's at the other side of, in this case, of Strait of Gibraltar, which is, you can see from Africa. You can see it. The promised land.
It's amazing. From Africa, and you look over and see Spain now. Are these people coming in? I imagine they're coming in for economic reasons, just for the promise of a better job.
Absolutely. Most of them, take Spain as a bridge, but their ultimate goal is to get to France or Germany. In a way, Spain has become a developed economy. We used to be a land where people would emigrate to other countries.
I
now, you know, with we your are hot a net economy. Absorbent of workers. Yeah.
Yeah. So with your hot economy, guest workers are staying there. Yeah. Are some of these? Most of these are not Moroccans. They're coming from all over Africa. Is that right?
Yes.
Are they?
Right.
Is there a drug trade involved in that also?
Well, there is some problems associated with migration, like, you know, crime and drug.
But it's mostly
dealing.
Economic.
But I wouldn't say, you know, I think the biggest mistake is always to assume that it's a one-on-one thing. You know, migration has a lot of benefits too. It's not only the diverse cultural landscape. It's also that, you know, for instance, the Spanish population had been one of the had the slowest growth in the world.
Right.
So our population is getting old.
Well, this is a reality that Europe has to deal with. Europe is becoming an old folks' home if they don't let in some immigrants to...
Yeah, and the immigrants are actually rejuvenating the population.
Are you unusual to have that sort of enlightened, broad, liberal approach to this?
Well, I think it's the majority of the people's take on this.
Now, in that vein, I was just in Granada. The Gulf, the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and so on pulled some money, gave millions of dollars to Granada so they could build a brand new mosque.
Mm-hmm.
And in Granada, they wanted to have a call to prayer right there in the middle of the old town. And Granada people said, oh, no, we can't have a call to prayer with any amplification. So I was there, and literally five times a day, a man climbs up to the minaret and he hollers from the top of the minaret, you know, God is great, and there's one God, and Allah is his prophet. This was quite impressive to me. And I talked to people, and they said, as far as the EU is concerned, Granada is sort of the administrative capital of Muslim issues in Europe. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, Andalusia in general, Andalusia, is, you know, where...
That's where the Moors were for 700 years. So that was the Alhambra. It's sort of the heritage in Europe from a Moorish point of view is Granada.
Granada is the last, you know, the last city that was reconquered.
So what kind of things would the EU be giving Muslims money for in Granada?
I would think for education, but I must say I don't really know that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing when you go to Granada. You really feel that Muslim culture is being integrated in quite a progressive way there.
Yes, it was that way, you know, in the 12th century.
I guess it's nothing new, is it? I mean,
for
centuries the Muslims were on top, and they were being, you know, flexible with Christians and Jews,
absolutely,
supposedly, and then now we turn the tables. Another interesting thing for travelers, I'm talking with Julio Astor, by the way, from the Tourist Board of Spain. Julio, when you go to Spain, it's just fascinating to think there's a little chip of Britain, of Great Britain in southern Spain at Gibraltar, and that goes back for military reasons for ages ago because Gibraltar kind of seals off the Strait of Gibraltar to stop ships from getting in and out of the Mediterranean, so a strategic place. When you cross the border there, you walk across an airstrip, actually. You got to really look both ways before you walk across because you don't want to get run down by an airplane. And then you've got fish and chips. You can go to the grocery store and get your digestive biscuits and some good tea. What's the latest in Gibraltar? Is it firmly with Britain, and is Britain on good terms with Spain? I know there were some serious problems in the past where you couldn't even cross the border.
Yeah, that was especially during the Franco time. Well, it's I don't know how to say that. It's something that bothers every Spaniard. You can understand.
It's a thorn in your national side.
Yeah, it's something that it affects our pride to have that for 300 years. And you know what a lot of people doesn't know is that it wasn't even won in a war. It was after a succession war in the 1700s. And we're not really happy with that. But we have, you know, the European Union has changed the approach to this too, because now Great Britain is an ally and it's a partner. So we have been able to, you know, put this aside. We will never accept that's not a Spanish land, but we can live with that.
And once again, as Europe unites, these issues are less thorny and problematic.
Absolutely.
So we can plan on cutting across the airstrip there to get some good fish and chips when we get tired of our tortilla espanoles.
Sure. And you can talk to a Bobby, and he probably speaks with Andalusian accent.
Oh, great. It's fun, by the way, to check out Gibraltar as a little side trip from southern Spain. You mentioned Franco. Of course, Franco was the dictator, and he was, like, controlled everything until, what year did he die?
1975.
See, every Spaniard would know that, I'm sure, because that was
a
turning point date.
November 20th, 1975.
Wow, 1975. I was just at the Valley of the Fallen, where Franco is buried. It's the biggest In a way, it's the biggest church in Europe. It's carved out of a rock by prisoners from the Civil War, and it's a huge mausoleum for the people who died in the Civil War. But right there at the high altar is Franco's tomb, and local people go there, and it's got a very powerful ambience. And some people go there to remember Franco, and other people, they say, go there to make sure he's still dead.
Yes.
Tell me about how Franco lives on in Spain, if he does. I know that there's a lot of scars. I know that some people still call their main squares Piazza Franco, although it's been renamed long since. But what's the political thing going on, especially for older people?
Well, I would say we were very fortunate to make a peaceful transition from, you know, the Franco regime to democracy. And we were able also to, you know, put aside all those resentments and hates that because of the horrible civil war. That was the main thing, you know. People, you know, when Franco died, a lot of people were still alive that had suffered that civil war, or if not, their parents had.
I mean, it ripped the country to shreds. It's like if Bush and Gore, the election had not been decided peacefully, and then people would just go to war with each other, and then Bush is in power for 30 years, like Franco, there would be lingering Goreites that would really have a problem. But when Franco died, it wasn't his hand-chosen successor was Juan Carlos, right?
Yeah.
And Juan Carlos apparently was a buddy with Franco, but he was very surprisingly modern and liberal to make this transition as painless as possible for Spain.
Yeah, I think there was a broad awareness among you know, most people that, you know, after Franco died, that this regime was not sustainable. We were in Europe, and you only had to look around and see what the other regimes were.
It was a time warp going back to Mussolini and Hitler, basically.
Yeah. It was not real.
Now, when you go into squares on a Sunday and you see all the old folks out there like they have been for 60 years, you notice the people who grew up during the Civil War are very short.
Yeah.
There's a whole class of people that spent their growth years in hunger. And
Absolutely. And
you can look around, and it's just a reminder to me of the very tough history that Spain had in the middle of the 20th century.
Yes, there was, you know, the war was terrible, but the post-war was probably even harder.
So in a lot of ways, Spain is got a lot to be thankful for.
Yes, absolutely.
And you're one of the most, in some ways, the most popular destination in Europe. I know a lot of Europeans love to go to Spain, not for a change of culture, but for a change of climate. And you've got these Brits and Belgians and Germans heading down to the Costa del Sol. I call it the Costa del Turismo. And what's a fascinating phenomenon to me, Julio, is I find that there's certain places that are famous among Belgians and certain places that attract the Brits. Have you noticed that?
Yes, absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about that. What about these little informal vacation enclaves?
Yeah, there are, I would say, the most, you know, 25 or 27% of our tourists right now are British, and like 20 to 22% are Germans. So those together are half our tourists.
And they like to, they probably don't go to Spain to hang out with each other, with Germans don't go to Spain to hang out with Brits, but they want to, a lot of them are probably these lowbrow tourists that don't even want to hang out with Spaniards. They just want cheap beer and lay on the beach.
Yeah, many, you know, many of them see Spain as a resort where they, you know, where they can get good weather and beach and sun. And, but apart from that, they're not interested, especially interested in the culture. So they kind of go to the same hotels that are, you know, German hotels or British hotels, although they are Spanish hotels, but they have specialized in one of the two markets. And there are even areas like, for instance, in Palma de Mallorca, there is the area of Magaluf that is British, and is the area of Playa de Palma, which is German. They are side by side, but not mixed.
So Germans know if they're going to go to Mallorca, they're going to go to that beach because that's where the bratwurst is.
Yeah, that's where the bratwurst is, yeah.
Well, now, I know that in the old days, working-class British people could only go to the south coast of England and lay on the beach in Brighton and imagine it being sunny. And now you can actually fly to southern Spain for about the same cost as a train ticket to the south coast of England. Has this changed the sort of dynamic of tourism in southern Spain, the cheap airfares?
Yes, it has changed a lot because what it has provoked is a lot of second residents. People got familiar with the landscape, with the area, and they had this. They started having this alternative to fly on a regular basis for so little money. And you have to take into account that we are within 2 hours, 2 hours and a half for most of Europe.
Yeah, it's like we have snowbirds. I'm in Seattle here, and half of Seattle, if they're over 65, they head down to Arizona or Southern California every winter like birds, heading for the sunshine. You would have the same thing in Europe, and Spain would be the sunny southwest, the Palm Springs.
It would be the California or the Florida of Europe. Yeah, no doubt about that. And there is, you know, there are areas in Germany where you have more flights to Palma de Mallorca, daily flights to Palma de Mallorca, that you have to other German cities.
This is another symptom of this unification of Europe and Europe thinking as one big place to enjoy your life.
Absolutely.
And I know in southern Spain you've got English language radio stations for all the British expats and so on.
Yes, you do have.
As a tourist, I don't want to go down there and see a bunch of Germans laying on a beach when I go to Spain. Let's talk about an unappreciated corner. Just to wrap things up, you're in tourism. You probably don't want to go to some condo filled with Belgians in the Costa del Sol either. What's your favorite place in Spain if you want to really enjoy traditional Spain and escape all the tourists?
I would say 90% of Spain is that way because although, you know, we have 53 million tourists last year, they are very much clustered around a few places. So you, even if you go to Costa del Sol, you know, the background of the Costa del Sol, those villages in the inland are pretty much still like they were a lot of years ago and very much authentic. And but, of course, you're close to the Costa del Sol, so you will find some tourists. If you want to be, you know, away from the current of tourism or the masses, I would say Extremadura, that jumps to my mind.
Yeah.
This region is southwest of Madrid.
Uh-huh.
Cáceres, Mérida, that area, Guadalupe. It's where most of the conquistadores were born, like Cortés, Pizarro.
53 million tourists go to Spain every year, and probably 80% of them end up on the Costa del Sol. One thing I learned was a lot of these famous Costa del Sol towns, Malaga, Torremolinos, Nerja, and so on, were once fishing villages associated with towns that were more important that were hiding up in the mountains into the inland. The pirates would ravage these fishing villages, so everything that mattered was tucked away in the hills inland. And today, those towns that are inland are much smaller, much more historic, much more affordable, and I think have a charm that a lot of American tourists might be looking for.
Yeah, all over the Mediterranean, that was the phenomenon, that the land close to the sea was the cheap land.
Yeah.
And no one wanted that because it was dangerous because of the pirates. And also because it was less fertile land. And, you know, of course, the tide has turned, and right now it's all the opposite.
Then the big money's down on the beach. And as American travelers, we've got to remember that Europe is a densely populated continent of lemming sun worshippers that seem to go on vacation at the same time, hit the freeways, head south until they hit the coast, whether it's in Spain or Italy or France, and they have an incredible ability to lay on congested beaches and have a good time. I would remind Americans, if you stopped an hour short of the beaches and settled down in the hill towns that are nestled up in the hills, you might have a more rewarding cultural experience and a little more laid-back, through-the-back-door experience, and then you can side-trip down to those beaches and enjoy all that fun in the sun at the same time. Julio, does that make sense to you?
Absolutely, and I would add that, you know, out of the 12 months of the year, I mean, if you can choose not to go in August, then July, August, then you're going to be more by yourself too.
I think you're absolutely right. I've always found that the most grueling thing about European travel is the heat and the crowds of summer, especially when you're on the coastline of the Mediterranean. Julio Astor from the Spanish Tourist Board, thank you so much for giving us an insight into your beautiful country, and best luck with your work.
No, thank you, Rick. It was a pleasure.
Okay, gracias. Adios.
Adios.
Travel with Rick Steves is brought to you by American Airlines. With their new Advantage Award booking tool, it's easier than ever to book to over 800 Advantage Award destinations online at aa.com. American Airlines knows why you fly.